All right. Welcome everyone to another episode of Geek Vibes Interview brought to you by Geek Vibes Nation. I'm your host, Dom Fisher, and today I have with me an OG in the film game. He's a writer, a director, and a producer. He's attached to such films as A Nightmare on Elm Street 2, Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, Trekkies, Piranha 3DD, Phantoms, Dracula 2000, just to name a few. Here to talk about his new film, My Best Worst Adventure, please welcome Joel Soisson.
Yes, sir. Thank you. Good to be here. Man? I'm doing all right, especially now.
Before we, you know, we go to like the your career, I want to talk about this new film, which just released digitally September 1st, everyone. Mm-hmm. And you know, if someone was to look at your catalog, this is very different than other films that you've been a part of. And it's crazy that you made this film, because I've wanted for a long time, like recently, I've been watching a lot of foreign films, and I was like, I wish there was a film that is able to tell a story without having to say that much, because the story is so universal. And then boom, you make this film that does just that. There's not a ton of dialogue, but the feeling and the movements and the connection that you can feel tells a story without having to need, you know, because if you didn't know people, the film is, was it filmed in Thailand?
It was filmed in Thailand, yes.
Okay, and then the dialogue we do see is mainly Thai, with a little bit of English, but you don't need to see the dialogue to understand what's going on. So what was that process like when you were writing this to shoot it this way?
Well, I got to take you on the road with me, because you explained everything exactly how I had wanted it to be done and unfold. I'm going to give a little giveaway of how old I am. The first movie that I actually wrote and produced was a film starring Lillian Gish. And for some people, that goes way back. She was one of the probably top five, if not the top two or three silent film stars of her day. And to go back and watch those silent movies that she starred in and other ones, is it's magical. Because we lost a little bit when talkies came into being. We lost the ability to show ourselves through the visual medium of film and not just hear what was going on. And dialogue takes so much of that away. So much of the art and the vitality of it is, in my opinion, often lost in words. And she taught me, like, first up, she was like 98 when I worked with her, but she just taught me the value of the silent image and what a gifted actor can convey without those words. And I kept that with me for what, like 40 years that I've been slogging through this industry, making different films, and finally got my chance to almost do it. And the hook into it for me was that the two leading characters, both young teenagers, 12 and 13, never speak a word. And that they're both lost souls in their own way. One is a transplant from Los Angeles who just doesn't know the language and can't communicate. And the other one is this poor mute local kid who's just lived a hellish life. And they kind of escape together on this adventure. And it for me, it's just transporting and magical and a little scary and kind of funny. And it allowed me to do all the things I've ever wanted to do in the last four decades that I never got to, which is tell an intimate story about real people in a horrific situation and still making us smile. And so far, it's been just an amazing experience just watching audiences respond to it. And you know, we're 100% on the tomato meter. I've never had a movie that even got to 60%. So that alone is just stoking the heck out of me. And I want people to see it because it's the movie I'm by far, I think, the most proud of that I've ever done in my life.
Yeah, and I think that another aspect of it is timing is very pivotal, right, for a film. Sometimes, mm-hmm. you know, you want to drop something before someone drops something similar or whatever the case may be. But this one, without having to be about quarantining or about COVID, you get this character who suffered a loss in Jenny. And like you said, she doesn't want to speak. She's going through all these emotions. She's angry. And I think a lot of people with our situation currently can relate to that and kind of see how she finds her way with this other character, can find some kind of like, you know, can relate. And also like, maybe I've been too hard on myself for this situation. Maybe I can find that light in the tunnel through something I didn't completely expect, you know?
Mm-hmm. Sure. And it is about that. And it's about, you know, what COVID has done to us, along with a whole lot of other stuff at the same time, is divided us into these camps where, you know, nobody like crosses the border, real or imagined, between people. And that happens culturally within our own country, obviously. And it also happens internationally with these artificially drawn borders, which you always hear astronauts, the first thing they remark on when they reach outer space is they look back and realize there's no borders at all. And that's kind of also what this movie's about. It's this kind of angry, self-obsessed LA kid. Never seen one of those before. And making her realize that this alien planet, so to speak, that she lands on is not full of monsters and weird predatory people. They're people with hearts and minds and gifts, and they're just fascinating, wonderful people that she ultimately finds out that they all have good in them. And that's sort of the underlying message, is this sort of bringing together of people and cultures and understanding, and understanding without words, because words kind of sometimes get in the way of this.
Yeah, I really like that opening scene where she's sitting and then, you know, looks over and, you know, she's like, why are you eating a bug? And it kind of just sets you in this like, okay, so she's kind of this fish out of water situation. So it really sets the scene in a big way of like what you're getting into. And especially like just a lot of the, it's very shocking when, you know, having to, without giving too much away, just end up being put in places where you may feel like you are part of this culture in a way, but don't know anything about it, don't know the language. So it's crazy how it matches up where she doesn't want to speak, but even if she wanted to, it might not help at all anyway.
No, because everybody around her is speaking like the parents in the Peanuts movie. It's just blah, 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 blah. And it's gibberish for her. So you have to connect on a different level or you don't survive. And there's also several elements of survival in this. I mean, this whole backdrop is set against the sport of buffalo racing, which is itself a really trippy thing that I discovered that the Thais do in the rural backwaters of the country, where kind of the rules are different. And, you know, 8-year-old kids can be riding on top of stampeding buffaloes. And the parents are like, well, I guess, you know, if we lose a couple from getting trampled, you know, that's that's sports.
Sure.
Right. But it was just insane. That sport is just, I'm sorry, I'm showing my cultural bias, but it's insane. And it was so ridiculously nutty that I had to document it before this sport disappears, which I think progress in modern, you know, basketball and football and baseball are going to ultimately just wipe it out. But this is a sport that needs to be seen. It's just too nutty to disappear.
Yeah, it's definitely one of those things where, you know, as in America, we steer clear of anything that's bigger than us. And you have this young man who's like very small, probably like 60 pounds on this like 800, 900 pound animal that could easily just toss him whenever it wants to. But there's that connection that it makes the movie that much more special, because it's something that you don't see very often, especially in person. Mm-hmm. I mean, unless you live on a ranch or a farm, you're not going to see a child and this giant beast just like sleeping on each other and like they're best friends. Was that experience you had seeing that? Was that why you chose Thailand as the backdrop for this story?
Yeah, it actually, I was in Thailand in Bangkok, totally opposite experience. The city and the crush of people and all the things that aren't in this movie. But the producer of that film, who was Thai, is Thai, wonderful woman named Charyawan Tavornan, was telling me about her own life growing up in like northern Thailand near the Cambodian border, one of those just little villages which you would never have, you'd never see it on the tourist map, let's say that. And she's the one that was telling me that this was her experience growing up. It's like if you or me were growing up on a farm and we just had like horses, you know, and we rode horses and nothing special about that. And we jump them and we race them and we sometimes fall off. Well, they the central animal in their world is the water buffalo. It's how they you know, farm. It's how they get things transported. It's their cars, their trucks, their tractors, everything rolled into one. And it's their family pet. It's everything to them. So to understand the connection of animal and human being in a different context than the one we're familiar with, also just sort of for me reinforces that universal thing that most of us have, which is this magical love of animals and this way that we can communicate with them, again, silently, but effectively.
Yeah, and like you said, with it being so universal, you know, I recently heard a quote that like plays through my head all the time when I'm watching a film, when I'm reviewing a film, and it's like stories that are so specific that they become universal, and that's what this film does. I mean, it didn't seem initially like it was like supposed to be a family film, but that's what it is. You know, it's, you know, with there being all the context being silent and personal, it makes it to where children can easily understand what's going on because they, you know, of course, they understand more things than we give them credit for.
Sure.
Because they watch and listen to everything. But I think it's something that they can really latch onto especially nowadays, you know, she's trying to journal and you have this, you know, being that she's sees as a representation that kind of follows her. And then the adventure of being kind of lost, but being okay being lost. It's really good, man. It's really good.
Well, thank you for that. But yeah, it's trying to work on a lot of levels. And one of the things that personally has always bothered me about family films is that they're, a lot of them are really good for kids, but the parents have to suffer through them.
Yeah.
You know, because okay, kid wants to watch this again for the fourth time, and oh man, I love Little Mermaids as much as anyone, but come on, this is killing me. And this one, I really think it falls under that kind of umbrella of family film, good for children. But I wanted to write and direct something that I would watch even without children, you know, right. Just like sit down and have a good time for an evening's entertainment. So that's another thing that I'm kind of proud of about this thing, is that it doesn't just stick and settle in that basket, you know, a family film.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like this is one of those films that could help reshape kind of what a family film is supposed to be. It doesn't have to be super lighthearted, campy type of thing where there's all kind of silly stuff going on because our life is, has more substance than just this willy-nilly thing that goes on.
And you're
So
right. Kids are aware of that. They cop onto it in subtle ways that they probably don't necessarily indicate all the time.
yeah, my stepson has definitely said some things. I'm like, how do you know that?
Watching you, man.
But to change gears just a little bit, you have a very long career, and when I'm looking at all these titles, I was looking at your IMDb page, and it's crazy to see what you're attached to, the things that are like these big cult classics, things that people want remade all the time. Is there like, did you know? I mean, I know you didn't know exactly when you're making them, but how far into the future did you know, like, I made something that's gonna last forever, become these big cult classics?
You know, that's a great question because looking back, it's kind of obvious which ones we're going to live and which ones we're going to fade away. And you do get a kind of an inkling. There's this sense, probably midway through the shoot that there's some kind of alchemy going on there that's going to result in something that will be lasting. And I've certainly felt that on a lot of the ones that did. Couple times on a couple that didn't, and I can ascribe that either to my bad judgment, which I certainly can own up to, but often also films are creatures of a time and a place, and for instance, and luck. Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, for example, is one that almost didn't happen. Even after we made it, because the executives who we made it for, about as old as I am now, watched the movie, which was totally about a youth experience, right? And a very specific youth experience of, of that particular moment. And I was part of that culture at the time. And but they hated it. They absolutely loathed the movie and refused to even put it out. So they just basically fobbed it off onto some little tiny independent company that like would, wow, here's a movie. Let's like see what we can do with it. And they actually put it in front of a real audience. Just gambled a little bit of pocket change to see what a real audience would say, not a bunch of dour executives going, what have we done here? It tested through the roof. People went nuts, and it became sort of a bit of a classic, I think. And we just had a remake, this year. And but that's where we all thought we were making something magical, and then it just turned out to be almost stillborn. And if it hadn't been for that little company believing in the film after the big parent company was ready to toss it into the scrap heap, there would be no Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. It would just not have a history whatsoever. So it is fragile. Even good films are these very kind of ephemeral things that may disappear if you blink. So I never take anything for granted in this business. You just got to keep pushing and pushing, even when it looks like it's going nowhere.
And especially because you started in the industry when it kind of started exploding and being more creative. It's crazy to think that, I'm sure initially trying to have these ideas, it's like, I don't even know if I can pitch this because it sounds crazy, but like I think it come together good, but like who do I tell and how are they gonna receive it? Or are they gonna like, you're nuts, man. You gotta go, so
The pitch is an amazing talent because you're always going to be up against people who are inclined to say no. Right. That's their default reaction,
right,
that most of us encounter daily and second by second in the film industry. And so you got to find a way into what they like. So, you know, if it's a movie about, you know, a rom-com about people having a series of dinner dates together, but the executive is a baseball fanatic, then you're going to be pitching the scene where they go to the baseball game and, you know, stuff goes nuts. You just got to know your way in.
Yeah.
And the art of that pitch and that making that connection to people is essential. And some people are really, really good at it. I'm getting there, but it's taken me like decades to even figure out how to. It's a psychological game, right? You got to sort of know your opponent.
Especially when you want to tell a story that maybe hasn't been seen or take place somewhere where they're like, I mean, I don't know if people find that attractive or sexy. Or
yeah, exactly. There's that famous, you're so right. There's that famous thing where some studio exec years back brought this writer in, this very famous writer, won't mention names, but the studio exec goes, I'm so tired of the same old thing. Everybody's copying everybody. I'm hating it. I want something new, fresh. We've never seen it before. That's what you got to give me. What do you got? Just something really, really original. And the guy goes, blah, 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 blah. And it was just totally that, right? And the executive sits back and he looks at him and goes, yeah, but what's it like? Because, you know, he can't wrap his head around something that really is an original movie.
Yeah.
It's like, it has to be like, you know, Star Wars part two. You know, it's just, that's where we're stuck.
Yeah.
And sometimes people break out of that, but it's hard.
I can imagine, you know, especially now with like, you know, I I'm with Geek Vibes Nation. So we cover everything Marvel, DC all the time. So I know that if I was, you know, one to pitch something, I'm like, look, it's just like Batman, except not Batman, but it's Batman, just different name. But then trying to come with something like completely opposite, like, well, is that going to make us $1 billion? Like, I mean, I don't know, man. It's a good idea. Yeah.
Well, that is the domain of the independent film, right? Because you've got now this new universe where everybody can make a feature on their iPhone, which on the one hand is like super daunting for guys like me going, I would like, when I started my career, there were 50 independent feature films made. Now there's like 20,000 in a year. And so my field of competitors has gotten a little bigger, but at the same time, it's competition, not just for money and you know, the big name actors and all the access to this and that. It's about the competition of ideas again. If you have something that is a really great, original, compelling idea, unlike when I started, you can do it. If you have a little bit of initiative and perseverance, you can do it.
Yeah.
And it's like writing a novel. We can all do it. We all have the laptop. We can all type words. Now it's not about the access to the laptop. It's about the quality of the words.
Yeah, you're very, very right. And I think that's why your new film, I think that's why it does stand out, is because initially it felt like a breath of fresh air. And I was like, oh yeah, this is what I need. Because, you know, it's... films can be good, but then once you kind of know what it is, you're like, I liked it, but I don't know, you know what I mean? Like it gets kind of disheartening at times, because I remember reviewing some films last year, and there was three of them within like 2 weeks, and they were all the same movie. And it became kind of hard, because I don't like to compare a film to another films, but when they're that similar, I was like, I kind of have to a little bit, just to let you know that, like, okay, if all these are John Wick, then only one of these can be the actual John Wick, and the other ones are going to be something a little lesser than, you know. It's, it gets difficult as a viewer.
If you go out and pitch that, I have this really dour dude that speaks in a really low register of his voice, and all he does is wear a long coat and kick people's asses. I think we're going to get, you know, that's a pitch that people are going to want to listen to, right? You know? And every time he punches the guy and he flies backwards and lands in a building and the building collapses, and we're going to have all sorts of great CG. I love watching digital mayhem. Don't get me wrong. I'm just, who doesn't like to see a city level by whatever. But, you know, I want to do a film about the guy in the back room that, you know, Superman punched a guy and he went into my building and it collapsed all around me. Now I'm stuck in a broom closet just trying to survive. Like, what happened? Nobody ever worries about them. They just like go on with the main movie. But yeah, some of it is just like at a certain point, we need to have a different spin on these genre films. We gotta get a perspective going that's a little freshier.
Where you started, was it with Dimension and the Weinstein Company, or was that like a little bit after you started?
I had been working a number of years in, I did the Nightmare on Elm Street 2 for New Line and a guy named Dino De Laurentiis, and briefly for a company called Canon Films, I think. And anyway, bounced around, did a film called The Prophecy with Christopher Walken, which is incidentally probably my favorite genre movie that I've ever done. If you haven't seen it, go see it. It's crazy. It's about the angel Gabriel, played by Walken, who decides to he gets pissed off at God because God seems to be favoring mankind over the angels. And so he gets a little jealous. And so he's looking to eliminate human beings, which is not really what God had in mind. And so there's a whole little dust up going on. And bottom line is Gabriel, it looks like, since he's been booted out of heaven, is on the verge of creating a new hell. And so who comes to save and rescue the humans is Viggo Mortensen as Satan, going, hey, wait a minute. Look, I'm fine for staying out of this, except I don't want anybody creating a second hell, because that's like stepping on my toes. And so there's all this kind of crazy stuff going on that is completely backwards from our appreciation of the Bible and the gospel and all that stuff. So anyway, we made this film and had a lot of great, great actors in it. And it was just really well done by my partner who directed it, Greg Wyden, at the time. that's what Dimension picked that film up. And that's when I started to work for Dimension and became pretty close with Bob Weinstein, the other brother.
Right.
I did work briefly with the brother who's more in the news at the moment.
Baltimore of the brothers.
Yes, the more notorious brother. And but he fired my sorry, but like the first weekend, we did not click. And so I spent the next, must have been 15, 20 years working at Dimension, making sure not to bump into Harvey in the hallways, because I was afraid he'd point out to his brother, hey, wait, what's that guy doing in my building? I fired him, you know? And I'm like, well, okay, I'll just sneak into this little room here as he goes by and saunter back out in the hallway when he's gone. It was almost like cat and mouse for 20 years. But we made a lot of good films at the, you know, during that period. And a lot of them were, you know, those genre films, the Hellraisers and the Pulses and the Draculas and the, oh man, even some Children of the Corn, probably way too many Children of the Corns, but they were sort of fun little larks to play around with. So yeah, there were some good years, but I really had to get away from that at a certain point, because it is kind of like, you know, punching out wax fruit after a while. It's not the real thing. It's like sequel number 11. Do we really need it? You kind of got to ask yourself. And I was sort of getting to that point of feeling it was all getting a bit stale.
What's really interesting is that you helped make films that millions of people have tattoos of characters from those movies. Like I have a Freddy glove right here, if you can see.
Oh, nice. Oh, I should have kept my Freddy glove. I would have sent it to you. I think you'd have dug it. Oh, yeah. Man.
There, you know, whether, you know, you feel that there was a lot or not of some of these films, like, you know, I have a lot of friends who, like me, love horror films. And I mean, I see Freddy. I just talked to one of the guys from Children of the Corn not that long ago. These are films that, like, they're going to last a long time. I mean, I'm part of some horror groups on, like, Facebook. Mm-hmm. And one of them is specifically 80s horror. So it's referenced, stuff like that is referenced all the time. But being now, like, or going forward, once you left the Weinstein Company, was it hard to have that name on your, that company name on your resume going to do other things with other companies?
The Dimension name or the Weinstein name, you mean?
Yeah.
No, because, you know, I was never, how do I put this? I wasn't a part of the studio. I was a hired hand, essentially. Okay. So when they wanted to make a movie, particularly a genre film, horror, comedy, action, teen sort of stuff, I had a company of my own called Neo Art and Logic, and they would call me and I would round up my troops and we'd go off and make the movie and they'd finance it. But there was always that sort of arm's length. I was never really a Dimension guy. And so there wasn't a lot to have to explain. I mean, if you eliminate all the people that worked with the Weinstein Company over the years, and just got rid of them, it would be great for all the up and comers, because there'd be a whole lot of shoes to fill, you know, a lot of empty ones, because pretty much everybody cycled through there at one point or another, either with Harvey or with Bob or both. Yeah. And they have their stories and wounds to show for it. But it was a rite of passage for a lot of us.
Yeah, and it's a good thing that it seems like a lot of people did keep them at arms. He's like, hey, I got to like stay over there.
Yeah, you know what? The only thing, and I'm not going to get on a rant about this, but I do think it's unfortunate, and it has to do with not just Bob and Harvey Weinstein. Happens with a lot of people, is that, you know, we often get blamed for what those who are close to us do that are not necessarily our responsibility or even in our knowledge sphere. I mean, I don't hold Bob responsible for what his brother did, and yet the collapse of everything that was had the Weinstein name on it, his brother destroyed everything,
right,
essentially. And I think that's kind of what I guess they call in warfare collateral damage,
right.
You know, when somebody gets hit by the shrapnel and they weren't even the target. And so you know, Bob had his detractors. I mean, he was a difficult guy to work with, for sure. But he was not a predator. Yeah. He was not in any way. Whatever tantrums or emotions he put out there, it was because he wanted his film to be better.
Right.
And if I know somebody's doing it for a purpose, if somebody's being emotional or you know, aggressive for that end, I'll deal with it. If somebody is being, you know, egocentric, inward drawn tantrum, you know, I'm only in it for myself kind of thing, then, mm-hmm. you know, bye-bye. Yeah. I'll see you later.
Is there anything from those films that you made back then, is there anything that you feel like that you may want to revisit because you want to branch off of the idea, or you saw a character that could have been transformed in a better way?
Oh my God, yes, on everyone practically. Not to the degree I hear that Woody Allen, who I've never had the luck to work anywhere near, but he allegedly will finish a film and then insist on reshooting every frame, because you get to the point, it's only after you see a scene or a movie or a cut or whatever that you realize what works and what doesn't, and how much better it could have been done if you just moved the camera, if you just gave the actor this line or this intention or whatever, and then you just, oh man, and then you just go to sleep and it haunts you in your dreams, and you wake up and you're just like fuming and kicking yourself because you only have yourself to blame mostly. And so, yes, I can't think of anything that I wouldn't want to just redo in a heartbeat.
Yeah, that's I do the same thing. I'll write a review and then I'll be like, oh, I forgot to say this one thing. Well, it's too late now, but maybe I'll tweet it, and then I don't because Twitter's hard. I don't.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Oh man, this has been going for a minute. This is great. I guess I'll try to round it out. So I have a fun question that I like to ask. If you were to be a cartoon character, what would your everyday outfit be?
My everyday outfit. Oh. It would be, you know, the bubble wrap that you have to.
Yeah.
I'd be wearing bubble wrap because I just love this idea that I could go anywhere and just like walk in front of cars or just jump off a building and just like bounce. I want to be able to bounce. Right. If I could wear something that had that ability, I would be just like, somebody could take a swing at me, like bring it on, you know.
Where can everyone find you on social media, if you're on social media?
I am on Twitter as Joel Soisson, Soisson. I think it's at, right? I'm not really good with social media. And our film is at My Best Worst ADV. I don't know why we didn't finish out the last word, but I'll leave that to whoever built the, it was my wife that built that, actually. She did it, but she'll answer to that. And then we have a Facebook page, My Best Worst Adventure. We're on IMDb. You can catch, you know, all the sausage making that went into it is all listed on IMDb and some reviews and stuff. And I think, you know, if you can find the film with your little Google devices, you know, just like type in the name My Best Worst Adventure and something will come up that will access you to get the film. We're on pay-per-view this month, and I think we start streaming next month or the month after, if I'm not mistaken.
Nice. This was great, man. Everyone, make sure you check out My Best Worst Adventure. Is definitely worth your time, because I know we're all in need for some substantial storytelling, and you know, this is it. I love this interview, just sit down. Like it just felt like we can, you know, especially because it wasn't a time constraint. So we got to really just talk it up.
That was a great time, man. I loved it.
Yeah. Everyone check out the movie. It's out now digitally. And until next time, man, can't wait to see what you're going to do next.
All right. Well, I got another one coming up with Danny Trejo, if you've ever heard of him.
Oh, yeah. I like Danny.
Kind of
the ageless one,
yes, and he only gets better looking every day. But yeah, I'm looking forward. We're shooting that in a week, and it's called Seven Cemeteries. So watch out for that one. Okay. I think you'll like it.
Yeah, I like that. Hopefully, we can talk when that is ready and prepared.
Hopefully, we'll be back to talk about that for sure. Because I just love talking with you, Don.
I appreciate it, man.
Dominique.
Yeah.
Okay.
So yeah, man, until next time, we appreciate your time. See you later.
Take care, man. All right.